Our second speaker this morning, our second team, I should say, is Chris Drockwitz and Tom Diamant. Chris, as I'm sure all of you know, is the founder of Our Holy Records. He's been coming to New Orleans, meeting with musicians and catching songs since the 1950s. He is very active today in the Our Holy Foundation, which is a major supporter of the arts. He's been very instrumental in the launch of online collections. He's a man of the moment, including the Frontera collection at UCLA. His experience in catching songs is going to be the subject of his talk this morning. I will hand out a handout that he has. You may have to share. I don't know that we have enough for everybody, but I'll be handing that out in just a moment. So, Chris Drockwitz and Tom Diamant.
Got to be the preacher, huh? All right. I'm not sure if I'm too good at that, but I guess, okay. We can't raise this baby up, can we? I guess maybe so. No. No.
Chris is doing the presentation. My name's on it, but I'm just sitting here.
Yeah, he's my tech assistant and also the manager of Our Holy Records and as well as the treasurer of the Our Holy Foundation. And every time I approach a computer, they balk. And so Tom is really my savior. I better start by telling you roughly a little bit about how I got into music here. I came to this country in 1947 from Germany. And I was sent to school in California. I listened primarily to hillbilly music every morning over XERB, which was broadcasting out of Rosarito Beach in Baja California. And I also, in 1947, heard my first encounter with New Orleans music, and that was when I saw the film called simply New Orleans. It had in it, how many of you seen that film, New Orleans? At least there are quite a few. It's an extraordinarily well-recorded music in it with Louis Armstrong, of course, but heading the Kid Ory Band. And that band just blew me away. Also in the film are Billie Holiday, Albert Ammons. And to me, I asked my friend when we were walking back from the movie, what do you call this kind of music we just heard? He said, that's New Orleans jazz. And so I was sort of hooked on that. And a few years later, I would listen diligently every Saturday night when over WDSU here, originating from the studios here, was broadcast the Dixieland Jam Big over the ABC network. It featured Papa Celestine's band on one side and Sharky Bonanno on the other. And to me, Papa Celestine's band was just the cat's meow. This powerful rhythm machine he had with Ricard Alexis on the bass, and I still remember all the names, I think. Alphonse Picou was on clarinet, Bill Matthews on the trombone, Black Happy Goldston on the drums, and, of course, Ricard Alexis, who could sing in French. He should sing, "Eh là-bas." Anyway, I said, oh, my God. So when I got out of the Army in 1956, I came to New Orleans for the first time. But I had actually encountered the George Lewis Band, of course, became extraordinarily popular also in the early 50s. And I must confess, me and Frank DeMond, who still plays with the Preservation Hall Band sometimes, we went to school together at Pomona College, and we would go every night to the Beverly Cavern to hear the Lewis Band. But my really weird part was to bring them to the Berkeley campus when I transferred up there in 1953, and I found out that if you became a member of the Big Game Committee, which is this rival thing between Cal and Stanford every year. You see, I couldn't care less about football. I had absolutely no interest in it. But I heard that if you joined that committee, you could decide what band to bring to the campus. And I took this whole bunch of kids over to the Hangover Club in San Francisco on Bush Street, where the band was playing every night, and they were just blown away. I mean, this was before rock and roll. And this powerful rhythm machine of the George Lewis machine, really, it was a machine. They played pretty much ensemble in those days, and they said this was the greatest music anybody had ever heard. And they packed Wheeler Auditorium at the big concert there. So that was my first attempt at sort of promoting the music I loved. And why don't we hear a little bit, Tom, from, this is Kit Schatz Madison, whom some of you heard in his prime yesterday as a little sample, but here with George Lewis, recording for Bill Russell. This is one of my favorite records. Cut things short because we're going to try to get a lot of goodies in here. And as I said, in 1956, when I got out of the Army at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, I came to New Orleans, heard Billy and Dee Dee at Lustgen's, and I remember the George Lewis group at some place on Bourbon Street. But I really became also a real strong follower of blues because I heard Hunter Hancock in Los Angeles on Harlem Matinee, and to me, the blues were something that absolutely spoke to me, and Lightning Hopkins became one of my absolute favorite. And what really got me to Texas for the first time was the fact that Sam Charters, whom I'd met in Berkeley, he sent me a postcard saying, I found Lightning Hopkins, he lives in Houston, Texas. And that was kind of like opening up paradise for me. So I took a pilgrimage really to Houston in 59, where I encountered Lightning Hopkins, and he said to come to hear him play that night, and I've never heard anything quite like it. I had just spoken to him that afternoon, you know, as a total fan, I guess, and when we got to the beer joint where he was playing, tiny little place with him, just him on his guitar and the drummer, and he was singing about how his shoulder was aching, and how his arthritis was bothering him, how he could hardly get to the job that night because the water was covering the chuck holes in the road. And then he pointed at me, whoa, man, this man come all the way from California just to hear poor Lightning sing. And I mean, I think it was totally, I mean, the only white guys that he'd ever encountered were people who wanted music from him, you know, who wanted to record him. And I guess I was the first fan that he'd ever met, sort of a strange bird indeed, I guess. And so I was devoted to, my attempt was, I told myself, I got to record this man in this setting. Of course, unfortunately, it never happened, but Mac McCormick, who was trying to be his agent in Houston at the time, he really introduced me to Houston. And so next year when I came back with a tape recorder, Lightning had gone to California, but I was introduced to the whole scene of Zydeco music that was just beginning to happen there. And thanks to Mac McCormick, who really knew Texas and Houston in particular upside down, he told me where these people were playing. They were mainly from Louisiana, almost entirely, who had come to Houston to work in industry, in the war industry and so on, and making some money. And I thought I'd actually, that trip in 1960, I'd also arranged with Paul Oliver, the British blues expert, to meet in Memphis after I came through Texas, and we were going to meet up in Memphis. And but before I got to Memphis, I recorded my first little taste of Zydeco music. I think this is the next one, isn't it, Tom? Let me see where we are here. Oh, no, I sort of skipped the piece. Let's just go to number three, could you?
Yeah.
Okay. This was on a Sunday afternoon, sort of a Zydeco contest, and one group after another was playing, and this guy had actually been to California. This was Good Rockin' Sam, He was the uncle of one of the Sam brothers, and let's just listen. I had a very primitive recorder.
Well, I just got back. I'm trying to call my name. Yes, I just got back, and I'm trying to call my name. But I just don't know just what to say. Won't let me jump. But I'm crazy about these women. God is hard.
I had one microphone, but I tried the best I could, and it was rocking that place, as you can tell. I encountered others and did that first little album called Zydeco. And Sam Charters once told me, says, Chris, you were really lucky to get into a kind of music that was just forming. And although it originated here in Louisiana, it became a really popular music in Houston because that's where the money was. On my way towards Memphis and New Orleans, of course, I stopped in Baton Rouge and met Dr. Harry Oster there, of course, who had recorded incredible amounts of amazing music, both at the Angola prison as well as amongst the Cajuns. I wasn't really familiar with Cajun music, except I'd heard his records, and when I drove through Lafayette, I'll never forget, my first encounter was, I asked a guy at a service station, you know, have you ever heard of any Cajun music around here? And he said, no, I wouldn't know, but you can go to Four Corners in Lafayette, and maybe you can ask at one of them bars. And so I did. This was before there was an interstate. There was just Highway 90 going through there towards New Orleans. And there was a real pretty girl as a waitress behind the bar, and I finally got up my nerve, and I asked her, have you ever heard any Cajun music? And she just broke out laughing and said, yeah, just last night, me and my boyfriend got really drunk, and you can't miss the place. We went dancing all night long. It was at the Midway Club on the way to Bro Bridge. Just take this highway, you're heading east. You can't miss it. It's on the left-hand side, big white dance hall. And I went out there, and I had never seen anything like it. Here was this dance hall with, I hope you don't get offended, but the men were very small, very short. And the women were huge. That's all I remember. And they were dancing in this counterclockwise circle. And they were playing one of my favorite tunes, God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels. And one guy was singing in French, and one of the singers was singing in English verses. And it was just hypnotizing. I mean, you either, I think, hate Cajun music or you love it. And I totally fell in love with this stuff. I said, I've never heard anything like this. Anyway, that was my introduction to live Cajun music. And when I got to meet Harry Oster, I did record a little bit Butch Cage and Willie Thomas, but I also hung around the areas because they were already sort of past, and I went to the black area of north of Baton Rouge, and I heard this amazing preacher in the streets. His name was Reverend Overstreet. I didn't get to record him until much later, but I first met him in the streets of Baton Rouge. Let me just play a little bit from a church recording I did later in Phoenix.
Hey! Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus.
He played the guitar, and he had four sons who played with him in the sound. Streets, he would preach much more. You're going to have a chance to hear some of that. We're going to issue a film pretty soon. sanctified church where you really bring the Spirit in and through dancing and praise the Lord through music and dancing. My next trip to New Orleans came in 1963 when a German filmmaker, Dietrich Wavzin, heard about me that I was somewhat familiar with what he called jazz, but I was really more into vernacular music of all kinds by that time. And he was doing a film for a German TV program, and he hired me to accompany him and to show him some of the places I had been in the previous 2 years in traveling in this area. And when we got to, he of course went to New Orleans, and I insisted that he record and film George Lewis, who was of course my idol. Since New Orleans has always been a pretty strong union town, they had to pay union scale, which was a bit on the stiff side. And in the rest of the country, there were either people would play music for them for free, like in Nashville, where they just went out of their way to, you know, trying to promote the music. And everywhere else, he did pay some to some people, you know, who spent time with us. But New Orleans was the only place where we really encountered a union scale. And so he only had a quartet. But let's just take a look at the, I think it's the only time that Lewis was really filmed. And here's his famous Burgundy Street Blues. Okay. Okay. Sorry to mix it up, Tom. It's, we're gonna. And he did, of course, his, it's a long, some of you may have seen it on the YouTube and so on, but Maureen, who's been the editor for Les Blank's film, she's helping me re-edit this whole material that we filmed that year. On my way back from that trip, we went all the way back to the East Coast where we filmed the J.E. Maynard Band in North Carolina. I had gone together with a friend of mine, Bob Pinson, and he played me a record by the Hackberry Ramblers once. And I loved the fiddler on it. I said, my God. And it actually was on the label. It said Hackberry Ramblers, Lutheran Darbone Fiddle. And so when I drove back from here towards past Lake Charles, there was a sign saying, Hackberry, go south. And so I went to Hackberry, and there was only one tiny little cafe. And I asked the lady, have you ever heard of the Hackberry Ramblers? And she said, oh, yeah, that's Lutheran Darbone. He lives back in Sulphur, just where you just came from, and you can't miss it. You go up the highway and turn right on Darbone Street. And it's this third house, I think, on the right. And sure enough, there he was, Lutheran Darbone. He said, oh, you're interested in my music? And he got together his band the next day, the Hackberry Ramblers. And I remember we did one day in Eddie Schuler's studio, but the next day I just hung my one omnidirectional microphone from the ceiling and put them in a circle under it. And this is what we recorded. So let's listen to the Hackberry Ramblers. Sound he had on that fiddle. I mean, it was just lovely swinging sound. And I brought them to Berkeley a few years later, and they played at a festival there. And I guess it started their career all over again. And thanks to Ben Sandmill here, who really did a heroic job of gathering together this group in their last go-around. I hate to put it that way, but... I tried to record them, but I lost patience. They were just totally out of tune, every single one of them. And how Ben Sandmill cracked the whip with them is beyond my... Anyway, I need to congratulate him every time I see him. Listen, you did wonders for them, because they really enjoyed their last years traveling all over Europe, and it was an amazing success for them, what he did. In 1965... I had gone to Houston to meet up with Horst Lippmann, who was taking every year the American Folk Blues Festival to all over Europe. And it had been a huge success. And however, he had been told by his French promoter, if you don't bring Lightning Hopkins, we won't put your show on anymore. And so he had heard that I was a pretty good friend with Lightning. And since we both spoke German, I guess, he said, listen, can you come down to Houston and meet up with us and talk to Lightning to see if we can persuade him to get on an airplane? Well, as I was hanging out with Lightning, I think it was just before Horst arrived, one night Lightning said, Chris, do you want to go hear my cuz? I said, who's your cuz? Cliff. I said, Cliff who? Cliff Chenier. And, well... that rang a little bell in my head. You know, I had heard Boppin' the Rock and ATFI, but that was sort of rock and roll. I wanted lowdown blues. But anyway, any place Lightning wanted to go, I'd go. And so he drove over to Frenchtown, which was sort of the southeast part of Houston, near the ship channels there. I remember the rats were huge crossing the street. Enormous rats. I've never seen such huge creatures. And when we got in the beer joint, it was a tiny little dive. And there was this lanky black man, tall guy with this huge accordion on his chest and just a drummer behind him, but playing the most amazing low-down blues and singing in this weird patois. I don't speak any French. But anyway, we as soon as he finished, of course, he came over and talked to Lightning, seeing a white man next to Lightning. He figured he must be some kind of record man. And so and so Lightning introduced me. This is Chris. Yeah, he's a record man. And of course, I didn't have a pot to piss in. I mean, but Clifton said, man, I got to have a record. I got to have a record. See, he hadn't had a record for a while. And so he talked me into calling up Bill Quinn at the studio that I'd met before. And the next day, we arranged for a recording session. And I told him, just bring this drummer. I want to hear this French music. Well, he showed up with a whole band, with a guitar player, a bass player, a piano player, a drummer. I said, Clifton, I just wanted that French stuff. No, I got to play rock and roll. You know, that French stuff ain't hitting on nothing. And so, well, the guitar player plugged in. He had an old Army amplifier, and it literally started smoking. So that was the end of that. And then the bass player, he had a really primitive electric bass. and he plugged it in. We couldn't hear nothing but put, put, put. Well, it turned out the paper cone had totally connected from the center of the speaker, and so there was nothing there. I said, "Okay, good." So we're down two guys. So we just had the piano player, and of course Clifton, and the drummer. The drummer was really good, and the other guys just sang. And we did this "Ay Ay Ay" underneath the evergreen. Well, I had met Papa Daly, and he was able to distribute that record. It sold a few. And I wrote to Clifton. I said, "Clifton, I want to make an album next time I come down, but I want that French stuff." And he was so reluctant, but we finally agreed, "All right, Chris, I'll make half the side of the album French, but I have to have rock and roll on the other side." I said, "Okay." And when we came to the French stuff, he had Cleveland by that time, his brother on rubboard, who was usually working with Lightning, and the drummer, Madison Guidry, wonderful drummer, and a great sound engineer. And this is one of the numbers that we did.
C'est pas la peine de brailler. Oh, mon chiffon. C'est pas la peine de brailler, petite fille. Oh, mon chiffon. Il donne tout mon argent. From my life, tous les jours, je parle les mêmes choses.
When he finished, Clifton would only do things one time, that was it. And he put in everything he had, and he came running out of the studio and said, "I got to call my old lady, she's got to hear this one." And so he called her, and Bill Quinn, who was standing behind me, says, "Chris, that thing will sell here, it's got that sound." And I loved it right from the start, but then I asked Clifton, "What's the name of that?" And he rattled off something like, "Tuli Jurgi Mebshars," whatever it was. And I said, "Well, how do you spell that?" "Well, spell it any way you want to." And, well, I mean, this whole language is an oral tradition, And I finally asked him, "Clifton, can I call it Louisiana Blues?" And he thought a minute, said, "Go ahead, call it Louisiana Blues." And that's probably the smartest thing we did, because if we'd have put this weird French on there, I don't think any disc jockey would have played it. But he'd had a reputation, with Boppin' the Rock and Etefi. And so it got played, and it got all over there. And the other side was Zydeco Son Pasale, which is, of course, the thing that really made him the Zydeco man. It's an old tune, but he did it in a most dynamic way. But the blues side, I think, is what really carried down there on the jukeboxes. And the radio played at KCOR, what was it, that station in Houston, and Papa Daly distributed. Anyway, I think I helped him. That side, the French side of the album, really is the one that became well known. And I think Clifton became proud of the fact that he had a unique culture. And that took him to France, where he was really proud to be able to speak to people there, although they had a hard time understanding him. But anyway, we had a great time, and I think he became known as the King of Zydeco. Shortly thereafter, I think, is it the next year, in 66, if you can put up the next picture, I came down and I was asked by Horst Lippmann to help put together a country music show. And I said, "You got to have some Cajun music." They hired the Stanley Brothers and Cousin Emmy and the New Lost City Ramblers. and they wanted a Cajun band. And I had just recorded Nathan Apsher. He was one of my favorites. You see, I could never afford studio, so I used to carry my little microphone. I think I had two mics on this session, maybe just one. And so I couldn't really record the whole electric band, but I basically did the, because I think we were considering Nathan Apsher as possibly, at least I liked him a lot. But anyway, let's hear a little bit of Nathan Apsher. Oh yeah, this is how I sort of met Mark Savoy. This was at a radio broadcast in Eunice, and I happened to be driving through on a Saturday morning, and the fellow on the left there is Reuven Reed, the announcer, and he had next to him a little toilet bowl on the table. I'm not sure if you can see it in that other picture, but there was always a whiskey bottle sticking out of it, and that's what they were all at 9 o'clock in the morning, going strong. And Paul Tate, he's the elegant gentleman in the Southern plantation suit. He is a lawyer from Mamou, and he must have realized, seeing me, that I was an alien from somewhere. And he approached me and said, are you interested in this Cajun music? And I said, oh, yeah, I love Nathan Apsher and people like that. And he said, oh, you like the authentic Cajun music. We try to present the traditional music here. I didn't know what the hell the difference was, but anyway, apparently he meant by the authentic ones the people who played in the dance halls, while he tried to promote more the amateurs, you know, but they would all get just as drunk as the professionals, I don't know, if not more so, and that was just part of the deal. But anyway, he said, well, you should meet a fellow named Marc Savoy, and he gave me a phone number. And I called it, and there was a woman answered, no, he ain't here, but try this number. And I called the next number, and it was a lot of racket. And the woman said, yeah, wait a minute. And then the voice comes on, yeah, this is Mark Salva. Who is this? I said, my name is Chris. I'm from California. Oh, from California? Well, come on over. I just ran over two chickens, and we're making the gumbo. We had to kill two more. And so that's how I met Mark Salva and the Savoys. They've been my best friends down here ever since, besides Lars here in New Orleans. But you see, it wasn't easy to meet people in those days, you know, because there were no newspapers that published where they were appearing or anything like that. Cajuns were totally the underclass. They were treated like gypsies. I'll never forget the first time I drove through there, and I asked at a service station about Cajuns. He says, what do you want with those people? I mean, they were really considered just like gypsies are in Romania. I mean, it's only been in the last 40, 50 years that all of a sudden now you have Cajun barbecue and Cajun tires and Cajun garages and Cajun everything. And that was not the case back then. Let's see. Let's listen to Nathan Apsher. I record this at a bar in Brazil. Hooked to that. Hunting for Cajuns to be on this trip to Europe. I love the Bro Brothers. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of them before. How many have heard of the Bro Brothers? Oh yeah, there's quite a few Cajun fans here. Good. Well, they made some wonderful records back in the early 30s and so on. And I had heard that they were still around, and we went to visit J.D. Miller in Crowley, who was sort of the imperial... I don't want to put it like this, the wizard of But I mean, he did put out some pretty dreadful records. But anyway, he sort of felt like he owned all these guys. Anyway, he pulled them over into his house, and Paul Tate and Reuven Reed and I went down there to listen to the Bro Brothers. And this is what I captured on my, I had a little portable Ewer that had a real cheap little microphone, but it was in J.D. Miller's office that I recorded this. Well, I wanted them to go, but I was totally outvoted by both Paul Tate and Reuven Reed. He says, Chris, you don't know their history. These guys were known for nothing but fighting. Every night they played a dance, they would fight on the bandstand, they would fight off the bandstand, they would get totally drunk. He says, we can't get these guys to Europe. They will never appear on time on any stage. And I said, oh, good God. Well, anyway, I was terribly disappointed. And they finally took the nice people who were playing the usual weekend shows. But anyway, that was my attempt to bring the raw stuff to Europe. But, you know, it wasn't easy. Okay. Over in Baton Rouge by this time, I was also interested in recording some of the blues. I was still around. Of course, J.D. Miller had recorded some of the best of it. But I met this a whole bunch of these people like Silas Hogan and Guitar Kelly and Henry Gray, the pianist. Let's listen to a little bit of Silas Hogan. He is the one in the middle. I must say, I've never seen roaches big as I did in Houston. I mean, those things, they were almost as big as the rats, but not quite. Okay. Oh, well, we got some more time. Okay. Well, we've got to hear a little bit of Canary here. This is number 10, Tom. Okay, Canary Fontenot, of course, was this wonderful Creole fiddler who played with Boisec Ardoin, and actually Dick Spotswood was the first one to record them. But Michael Doucet, whom I had met, I think, by this time, this was in 71, yeah. And he wanted to accompany him. He adored these older guys, and he learned from them, and not just Dennis McGee, but also Canary Fontenot. And so why don't we hear a little bit of Canary Fontenot? Michael Doucet plays a mandolin.
J'ai trouvé ce langage peu aimé, j'ai trouvé ce langage peu avoir, j'ai trouvé ce langage peu aimé, elle a été née dans la Louisiane. Et ma Linda, la plus belle sur les terres du Bayou. Et ma Linda, elle va être la mienne pour la vie durant.
That same trip, I think I came here to New Orleans. Of course, I'd been there almost every year, ever since the first jazz fest and so on. And I'm not exactly sure, Lars Edegren, you probably remember how I first met you.
Actually, it was in Europe.
Oh, in Europe we met.
Ah,
I see. Well, by this time, though, he was over here, a young Swedish immigrant. You see him on the right side there. He's the pianist. And if you were around last night, he was playing at the Palm Court, wonderful piano playing. Anyway, I was intrigued by the lovely sound. I knew I couldn't afford all the other jazz bands. First of all, their heyday had been passed, and everybody else was recording them. And I had never encountered quite a nice sound like this, especially this was during the ragtime craze, was it? And these, it was before, okay. And these guys played it in such a lovely sound. And, of course, Bill Russell, my hero, who's on the violin, who created all those incredible recordings by Bunk Johnson and Kid Schatz and George Lewis for his AM label. Anyway, let's play a little of this orchestra. And we recorded this at Cosimo Matassa's studio. It short, but it's all available on our Hooli Records. And I just want to say a word about Cosimo. I mean, he was fantastic. He had 8 microphones for all the guys in the band, but he didn't have enough preamps, so he took 2 out of another tape machine. Do you remember that? And I do remember that very vividly, and finally hooked the stuff up together. And how he got this incredible sound is just beyond me. I mean, he just beautifully balanced, and he's a genius. The guy is absolutely, and of course, most of you know him from recording Fats Domino and all these R&B bands here. But he also recorded that amazing session of the George Lewis Band with Elmer Talbert for the Good Time Jazz label, you know, which really captures that whole rhythm section and the power of that band. Now, Cosimo, he's still around. Go to his little store. Is he over there still sometime?
Yeah.
Okay, I have to go visit him again. All right, we have to jump up ahead a little bit. Let's do a little bit of Marc Savoy and Dewey Balfour, number 12. I've met Dewey through Nathan, and DL is known as the Cajun Hank Williams singer, but on this one, I think Dewey sings it. I mean, these were sort of the 3 giants of Cajun music at that time.
Oh, toi, tu fais, charmant, je suis parti. Oui, pour m'en aller, là-bas dans la chalounette.
And then a little bit of 15 now. I'd met, of course, Beau Soleil, people that told me about Michael Doucet, and But when I heard the band, I thought, oh my God, this is the most sluggish outfit, and I just wanted him. And so he first showed up in the little chapel that he was working. He was working for the church in Lafayette at the time. He only had three of them. I sounded real nice, and all of a sudden, the whole rest of the band wandered in. And Michael said, no, Chris, we got to record the whole band. Well, anyway, we did record some really nice, almost solo-like things. Let's hear. During the first session I had with Michael, he did this song. Just his brother David on the guitar. In 1989, I got together with Les Blank after I filmed with him sort of the history of border music. I said, I was really inspired by Anne Savoy's book about Cajun music. And I said, oh God, somebody has to document this on a film. By that time, I'd gotten to know Les Blank pretty well. And I put all the money I had and put it into this film that we did called J'étais au bal. And we were very lucky enough, I got to know Quint Davis, and he finally gave me permission to film at the Jazz Fest, which was really, really difficult, because it was all union, but they knew Clifton wasn't union, and so we did capture Clifton Chenier at Jazz Fest in 1989. Do we have the Treme Brass Band set up? Okay, well, I'd also recorded the Rebirth Band at a beer joint. That was really something. But this one was a long way in coming. They did some studio stuff, but they wrote a new song for it. It was called Give Me My Money Back, and that actually became a big song during Mardi Gras that year, and that's what sold the whole CD. But the part I liked was when they did this live broadcast from the Music Factory.
Get with the program!
Get with the program! And so this is part of that CD by the Treme Band. After I heard the broadcast, I called him up, I think. I said, this is WOZ, have you got a tape for this? And he said, yeah, we did it. It's
So this is from the tape that W.O.D. recorded.
I got to play one by the Savoy family, my all-time best friends down here. And this is with Anne singing. And they have created this amazing group of two of her boys. Of course, Wilson plays the accordion and piano. And, of course, her husband, Mark, is on accordion. And Joel, the son, plays violin.
Toi, t'es tous les jours dans mon lit. Et toi, t'es tous les jours pas presque. Quand même tu médites loin, faudra, je sais, l'endurer. Et toi, t'es tous les jours dans mon lit.
Go to Wilson Savoy, the guy in the back there. He has his Pine Leaf Boys. And this is the one with Bill Cedric playing with him. But I always love this song. It was God who made honky tonk angels. Let's go out with the Magnolia Sisters. This is one of the many groups that Anne has put together, and that is one of the most charming groups. And let's listen to them, the Magnolias.
À boire, à boire, je paierais à boire.
Un petit coup qui trempe pour nous mettre la raison. Buvant, chantant gaiement, mais perdant jamais la raison.
Les Acadiens sont pas si fous, à nous laisser sans boire un coup.
À boire, je paierais à boire, je paierais à boire.
La ville pincourt et la paroisse crête.
Well, I guess we have to call it quits here. And I'm sure this was a bizarre little trip through 50 years. And anybody, do we have some questions?
Just a couple of questions. We have to make this short, but does anyone want to ask a couple a question?
Anybody at all? Or otherwise, yeah.
Chris, what are you going to do next?
I don't know. It's the record business is finished, so I'm spending a lot of time on the Arhuli Foundation, where we, thank God, just got a huge grant from the NEH to complete the digitization of our Mexican 45s, and that's the Frontera collection. That's been really an enormous project that we've taken on, and so hopefully we'll finish. This is a period of 3 years that grant covers. And there's also, I'm going to put out this film that I on a DVD, I don't know if it'll sell or not, but of this trip that I took with the Waftzins that had the George Lewis band and also has a Bell Gal. Has some amazing stuff. We also filmed some Native Americans in Gallup, New Mexico, and gospel music and blues and hillbilly music, and went to Nashville. So that's coming out this fall on our 50th anniversary tour. And if any of you are interested in our film, J'étais au bal, which is really the story of Cajun and Zydeco music, I have a few extra copies if you want to buy one. Any other questions? Nope. Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
One last thing before you leave. Our outgoing president, David Soibert, wants to remind everybody, particularly the new members, that the business meeting at 4:15 this afternoon in this room, be there or be square. The silent auction closes in about 25 minutes right outside, and we'll reconvene at 11:15. Thank you.